world tomorrow. As recorded before a live audience in Pasadena, California, Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
Well, I was living in Temple City, California, back in about 1953. We had, my wife and I had taken a trip up to Oregon, and I had met some of my old buddies that I had known. As a matter of fact, they had influenced me to go into the Navy a little bit. And they were identical twins who had been born and reared in Oregon. And we had spent about, three or four days up there and had gone to dinner with some of my old high school buddies. And I introduced her around to some of the people that I had known, including this young couple. Now, they lived in the same old white house they lived in when I was a boy, down on 9th Street in Eugene, Oregon. And I had stopped by to see their folks, and we'd gone out to dinner together. And one of them had just barely been married, and the other one was about to get married. It seemed that two girls had moved in next door, one girl who brought her girlfriend with her from back in, Nebraska. And they were such close friends in high school that the one girl came to live with the other one and get a job in Eugene. And so Ron and Don, who were identical twins and with whom I grew up, I used to sing in a musical group with four, another kid called Don Merriweather, and there were four of us. You could lay a board across the tops of our head that sang all over Eugene and on radio and in Big MacArthur Court before a big university group and so on, different church socials and so on around the country. And they were very athletic. We played basketball together for years. We went hunting together for years. We did a lot of things together. They stayed at my house and I stayed at theirs and so on. So, of course, it was great to renew the acquaintanceship again and to meet the girls that they were either married or going to marry. And so I came on back down to California. We were driving an old, 1950 Chrysler convertible. And I guess the morning after I arrived, or the second morning, I was awakened quite early, and the telephone rang, and I got a call from a girl up there that had married another of my friends up in Springfield, Oregon. And she told me that on the way home from a drive-in that night, a double date between Ron and his newly wed wife and Don and his wife-to-be had ended in a bloody automobile collision. And I said, oh, no. And I said, was anybody hurt? And she said, well, yes. And so little by little, I kind of get it out of her. And all four of them were dead. The next morning, I received in my mailbox an invitation to come to Don's wedding. He had mailed the invitation the day before or so. It took about 3 days, apparently, to arrive down here, and I got the invitation to his wedding to be a day after I knew that he had died in an automobile wreck. Now, I did not blame God, but I certainly did wonder why. I was in the pulpit in Springfield, Missouri. I looked out of the Falcon window here the other day. We were going back down, and there was Springfield under our right wing, and it reminded me as I looked down and saw some of the features and the landscape of the area where we had been in 1958. The phone rang one day, and it was my father, and he told me that my brother had been in a serious automobile accident. And again, I said, oh no. So little by little, they spell out exactly what had happened. And it had crushed his wrist, it had broken his elbow into bits, it had broken several ribs, it had shot the lung clear up against the heart and displaced it and pushed it way out of the normal place. It had fractured his jaw in several places, broke it to bits and pieces, and he was in very terrible shape. Now, before that particular campaign was over, and it was supposed to last 6 weeks, this was in about probably the third week of that campaign over in Springfield where I was preaching, I believe, six nights a week, and then on the Sabbath as well to the local church, Mr. Norman Smith called to tell me that my brother had died. And again, I shouted into the telephone, oh no, so I couldn't believe this. It was very hard to accept, and of course at that time, I think that for a time I fully expected, because he was a minister, and he was the first of the ministry in this phase or modern era of the church that had died, that he would be resurrected. I almost expected that somehow maybe he would come back to life. And I had a real tussle with that. It was a very hard time to know why that had occurred. Well, I was up at the National Association of Broadcasters Convention in Chicago, where I met Paul Harvey here last year. A man came up to me quite serious after my presentation of the invocation and brief remarks before one of the groups, a very large group of about I guess a couple of thousand radio and television owners and managers and so on. Introduced himself as being the manager of a radio station up in Fairbanks, Alaska. And he told me that he and his wife had twin children. And they had been driving, I guess, from Fairbanks down to some other town, probably to Anchorage. And they had stopped along the road. It was very, very cold. And apparently the children were asleep in the car. And in order to keep heat in the automobile, they left the engine running. Well, unfortunately, even though the parents got very dizzy, very drowsy, and a headache, and then finally discovered what was happening, the children were much lower, and carbon monoxide apparently creeps up because it's heavier than air from the bottom. And both of the twins had died. And this man asked me, because he had been to every minister he could find, and his wife had been to everybody that she could ask, why did God let it happen? He wanted to get some kind of an answer. And I told him, I said, it was time and chance and circumstance. I said, God had nothing to do with it. And he looked at me in amazement, and I said, no, it's a fact. I said, tell your wife to think, if she possibly can, about the millions of people in the sub-Sahara, about the millions of people in India, in China and Africa and Asia, about the tens of millions of human beings around this earth and of the millions who die every year, of the life expectancy of the average Filipino child, which is 50% dead in the first year, of the life expectancy of so many people living in impoverished areas such as in the island of Haiti, or Haiti as they call it, where you can see people along the side of the road scooping up dirt to put in their mouths, and where a tremendous percentage of the population have intestinal diseases because of waterborne bacteria. And make her realize that it was just one of those things that happens to hundreds of thousands of people, but that she was not singled out for any special treatment from God. I remember a woman in this church years ago who was quite emotional, she and her husband, and I believe they had lost one baby either by crib death or some other form of a horrible problem that had taken the life of a very young child. It happened the second time, only this time she began to blame God, and she began to scream out to God. She tried to call out to the name of God, and she blamed God for letting it happen. I don't remember all the details exactly, but I do remember that the woman, as they would have said clinically, became insane. What we in the ministry thought was that she, in her outrage, had allowed a demon to come into her mind and had actually become possessed of a demon. And later on, I think Mr. McNair remembers this case because he had to deal with it personally, as I recall, up in the Seattle area. And it sort of went back and forth, but this lady was actually institutionalized because of an attitude that had stemmed from a complete inability to accept a terrible tragedy in her life without blaming some outside force, without blaming some other being, especially God, who might have interfered. Now, there are extremes, I suppose, in both directions, and people sometimes accept the death of a loved one almost stoically, with, perhaps difficult to understand for some of us, lack of emotion. Most people do not. Most people tend to blame almost anything. The weather, the elements, the cut of the grass, the groundskeeper on the golf course, the AMA, the doctor who didn't tell them, the bus driver, the man in front of them in the automobile, the guy who manufactured the poison, the person who painted the wrong kind of paint on the toy that had lead in it, almost anybody or anything, including the elements and especially God, for accidents and for tragedies. Now, we tend to congratulate ourselves for our successes. Men like to brag about being self-made men. We like to show and display things that we have made. We like to discuss our accomplishments. When we have healthy and happy children, we like them to show off their best and display the great talent and the ability that our children have. So we tend to congratulate ourselves and keep God out of our conversation as long as things are going well. And we tend then to blame God when things are going very badly. It has been that way, by the way, from the very beginning of all creation. Clear back in the Garden of Eden, that's exactly what Adam and Eve did. I wonder how many times you've had a problem which is so serious that it's gotten you really emotional and worked up about it. Now, of course, a lot of us have problems like that pretty often, whether it's over money, your love life, your job, being treated unfairly, an individual was divorced, And so later on, as the years went by, because it seemed that the religion had become a factor in the divorce case, he began to blame the religion for the loss of his wife, when in practical fact, when the gal walked out the door, he breathed the biggest sigh of relief you've ever heard. He wanted to get rid of her in the worst way. But years downstream, it's pretty easy to use the work of God, and therefore God himself is who's the person you're really pointing the finger at, as the whipping boy for your problems. I wonder how many people fall into that trap of using God as the whipping boy for the problem, instead of recognizing where the problem truly is. Clear back, beginning in the second chapter of the book of Genesis, where God had put a man and a woman in the Garden of Eden, and commanded the man, gave him an order about how he was to take care of his newfound environment, you're seeing the beginning of the lesson of human relationships to God and God's relationships to human beings. These are the first human beings. Adam is the first man. You're seeing the reaction of human nature to orders and to a regulated society over which God is in charge, beginning in the 16th verse of the second chapter of Genesis. He was put there to dress and to keep the garden, and the eternal God commanded the man, saying, "Of every tree in the garden you may freely eat, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat of it. For in the day that you eat thereof, you shall surely die." Now, people have argued incessantly, I guess, what that tree was. Was it representative of sexual knowledge, representative of religious or philosophical knowledge? Was it an actual tree? I believe it is both. I think that it's actually a specific tree that was in the garden that bore fruit. Doesn't say of what type, whether apple, as tradition has it, or what. But it also represented something. Perhaps people have even argued that it had a certain type of a narcotic effect. I think every idea you can imagine has been set forth about what kind of a tree that was. Of course, a lot of people feel there was no such tree, no God, no garden, and no Adam and no Eve, so far as that's concerned. The eternal God said, "It is not good that the man should be alone. I will make an help directly answering to, exactly compatible to, or help meet or fitting for him." And out of the ground the eternal God formed every beast of the field, every fowl of the air, and brought them unto Adam to see what he would call them. And whatsoever Adam called every living creature, that was the name thereof. So he gave names. The deep sleep was caused to fall upon him, verse 21. The rib was taken, and woman was made. In verse 23, Adam said, "This is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh, and she will be called Isha in Hebrew, because she was taken out of Ish." And so it was merely a termination of the root word that meant man, and that still is true even in the English language. Instead of man woe, it's woe man, but it really comes from the same term. Man and woman stem from the same root form. "Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother, and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. They were both naked, the man and his wife, and were not ashamed." Now that is quite a profound statement to me as I think about it. People today like to go into nudity. There are all types of nudist colonies around. Pornography is everywhere. X and triple X rated theaters dot the landscape of all of the big cities. But the point is, today, nudity usually brings about a sense of shame, especially in a public place. Adam and Eve weren't ashamed. They weren't ashamed together. They weren't ashamed in front of the animals. They weren't ashamed in front of God. But the main thing is, they weren't ashamed in front of God. Now, they had the world's biggest bedroom in all of history. There wasn't another human being in 1,000 miles any direction, or 8,000 miles for that matter, so it was complete privacy. It wasn't a nudist colony. But there was a talking animal at that time, a talking beast of some sort. And if you were to look into the book of Isaiah, Isaiah 1, Isaiah 6, and what Ezekiel saw in the first and tenth chapter, and try to define exactly what is a cherubim as opposed to what is a seraphim, how many wings did they have, what did they look like originally, you would almost have to see something that looked like what we would call in ancient fiction and some mythology a dragon, but which stood upright, which had a tail, which had a serpentine type of a head, but which before the repugnance which was to come upon man after the curse upon that serpent might have been, I guess, to an unpracticed eye, a rather striking and maybe even a beautiful creature. At any rate, it wasn't any more surprising to Adam and Eve to have this creature stride up to them, complete with folded wings, long tail, and serpentine head, and start to talk, than it was to be talking to a creature a great divine being who maybe shimmered a little bit with a glow like an iridescent hue, who knows, but who appeared more or less manlike to them and who talked in a voice that sounded like thunder, because after all, they're a new creation. How many of you kids, when you grew up on the living room floor, went shrieking out the door the first time somebody's face came on television? You didn't understand it. Didn't know what made it work. You didn't know how that person got in there, but you sure enough took it for granted. I mean, we grow up with things that are marvels of engineering and of technology, of invention and design, and we take them for granted. You know, while I was up in Colorado, I was wondering to myself, because we're sort of right underneath one of the major jet routes, and you're way up there and it's very still, and I walked about 8 or 9 miles that day and hunting along here because I didn't shoot that one in the morning. I waited until way evening, but hunted all day long. And every now and then this jet airplane would go overhead, way up at altitude, and you'd hear this dull roar. And it made me wonder whether or not the very first time those elk herds ever heard a jet, if it scared them, if they looked around, if they were looking for something, if it bothered them. And I just thought, well, isn't it strange that here we are in an absolute wilderness area, unspoiled and untouched, not even any roads in the area that I was walking between some jeep trails where we had gone. And yet, here's the sound of modern technology grinding away, only about 8 miles up there, and the sound of huge jet engines bathing the landscape with a rumbling noise. And, of course, I wondered whether or not that doesn't kind of bother the animals. Apparently not. Apparently they take it for granted. They don't go jumping around wondering what it is. They're used to it. They pay no attention to it whatsoever. It's amazing how quickly we can take things for granted. I don't know just how surprised Balaam was. And I'm not going to get trapped into saying it the wrong way either. Now the serpent, it says, beginning in verse 1, third chapter, was more subtle than any beast of the field which the eternal God had made. And he said unto the woman, Now, yea, has God said, You shall not eat of every tree of the garden? And the woman said unto the serpent, We may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God has said, You shall not eat of it, neither shall you touch it, lest you die. Now so far so good, because God said that, not to the woman, but to the man. So far, we have the record that Adam taught Eve something after she was created and told her, by the way, honey, that one in the middle you don't touch. All the rest of them are ours, but you can't have that one. So far, so good. The serpent said unto the woman, You shall not surely die. I believe it does say in Spanish, doesn't it? Más sabe Dios, which means God knows more, God knows better. And in the original, that is implied, God knows more than he's telling you. He knows better than that. Apparently, God is lying to you. You won't die, for God does know that in the day you eat thereof, then your eyes shall be opened. You'll be as gods. You'll have a higher level of understanding and of comprehension, knowing good and evil. Now, of course, everybody wants to know evil. Evil is only measured in comparison with good and good with evil. And those are standards or mores or values that we have to learn just as much as little babies have to learn what is up and what is down, what is right and what is left, and what is far and what is near, and what is long and what is short. And we have to learn by comparisons. And they show us pictures of what is short and what is long, and what is far and what is near, and what's an inch and what is a mile. And we would not even be able to walk along upright except that we live in a society that recognizes various orthographic projections and scales and sizes and shapes. And we learn as a child what is a circle and a square and a triangle, what is rectangular, or what is oblong. It is only in that comparison that we can come to know what is up and what is down. I suppose if you've seen that movie that they show as one of the proofs of God, of the fellow who put on the tremendous binoculars that changed his vision to upside down so that immediately he saw everything utterly upside down. Other people were coming, walking along the ceiling as far as he was concerned. In a matter of, I forget how long, perhaps months, perhaps weeks, his brain turned the image that his eyes were showing him, and he was again seeing exactly as you see, but in practical fact, the eye was forced. You know, your eye actually does do that. It changes everything, and you see upside down. But the brain turns it around to make it appear right side up. They have proved that the human eye does invert it and flashes it on the brain, if that's the way to say it, in inverted position. So he took the glasses off. Now all of a sudden everything was upside down again. And his eyes proved capable, though he had dizzying headaches and nausea and had trouble sleeping and all of that. You can imagine the mental problems he went through. But his eyes proved capable of changing that around to where once again he was seeing right side up. We only know these things by comparison. What comparison did Adam or Eve have between good and evil? Evil was only a word. It was apparently something that was desirable. It was something they wanted to know about. Someone said you got a chance to hear some dirt. You got a chance to investigate some evil. You got a chance to know the really seamy side of what's around down here. And so, of course, they wanted that. And the serpent had a pretty good argument. He guaranteed them life. He said, you're not about to die. Probably, he even insinuated, they had an immortal soul. Well, the woman then performed the experiment that we've talked about, the first scientific experiment of wondering whether or not God was right. She saw the tree was good for food, that's lust of the eyes, pleasant of the eyes, a tree desire to be make one wise, which is coveting. She took, which is stealing, of the fruit thereof, and did eat, and gave to her husband, that's conspiracy, and he did eat, and that's also a sin on his part, and the eyes of them both were opened. Now, wait a minute, their eyes were opened before because we just read that she saw the tree, that it was pleasant to the eye. Well, is it a contradiction of Scripture, or is it that they were opened in a different way? That the human eye began seeing something, or attributing something, better said, to what it did see, that it had not seen previously. The eyes of them both were opened, and they knew that they were naked. Now, isn't that funny? I would think anybody would know he or she was naked by a simple glance. Human anatomy is not all that, subtle. There you are, and you're naked. But they didn't know, because naked didn't mean naked. Naked meant natural. Now, they try to use those terms on people today to get them all into this kind of sexist nudist colony business about going in the natural, or the altogether, or what have you. But in practical fact, Adam and Eve had a completely different mental point of view concerning the human physical body prior to the time they sinned and after the time they sinned. They knew that they were naked, and it embarrassed them. Suddenly, they attached something dirty, something evil, something wrong to that fact. So they had to cover it up. They sewed fig leaves together, made themselves aprons and skirts to run around in. And the savages in savage societies are still doing that, in some cases using, quite literally, leaves, even to this day. And they heard the voice of the eternal God walking in the garden in the cool of the day, and Adam and his wife hid themselves. I wonder if you can think back in your life, and if you had something against someone, if you had recently had an argument or a fight, someone you don't like, someone that you think doesn't like you, someone who gossips about you, or you gossip about them, whatever. Someone that you feel is a dissident or a dropout. Have you ever in your life walked clear across the street to avoid meeting someone you saw coming down the block? Have you ever just almost come to the door and heard a voice and thought, hold it, that's so-and-so there, and I don't want to see him or her. Turn around, go right back, and go someplace else because you just don't want to meet that person. Have you ever had a situation develop where you, in a sense, recoiled or hid yourself from an impending, unpleasant situation because of an association of guilt, an association of blame, an association of something that was evil, something that was wrong between you? Well, if you have, then you understand how Adam and Eve felt. Here came a voice of the one who was in charge. He called out, but they hid themselves. And the eternal God said, Adam, where are you? Thus showing that God was limiting himself, appearing as a man, limiting his vision. He wasn't playing games or kidding. He literally couldn't see Adam at that moment. He was seeing as if with physical eyes. And he said, I heard your voice in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked. And I hid myself. I didn't want you to see me the way you made me. I want you to see me faking it. And so he said, who told you you were naked? Have you eaten of the tree whereof I commanded you that you should not eat? The man said, the woman. She's the one who was guilty. She gave it to me, and I did eat it. So really, God, it's your fault. Now, maybe you don't follow that reasoning, but that is the reasoning that I believe God followed and got it quite well. Because the word you is in that sentence. The woman whom you gave to be with me, she gave me of the tree, and I did eat. And the eternal God said to the woman, what is this that you have done? The woman said, the serpent beguiled me, and I did eat. Everybody was wanting to blame some other circumstance or somebody else. And the Lord Eternal said to the serpent, because you have done this, you are cursed above all cattle and every beast of the field, and upon your belly you shall go, and dust you shall eat all the days of your life. and then the remainder of the statement, including that prophecy of Christ, the bruising of the heel of Jesus by his crucifixion, the bruising of the head of the serpent by Christ's overcoming, and unto the woman, the multiplication of her sorrow in conception and childbearing, and that the husband would bear rule over her. In verse 17, unto Adam he said, because you have hearkened unto the voice of your wife, and have eaten of the tree of which I commanded you, saying, you shall not eat of it, cursed is the ground for your sake. In sorrow shall you eat of it all the days of your life. So there is the story of how the very first man got a guilt conscience and began to hide from God, and then because of what he had done, because of guilt he felt, began to blame God. Began to point a finger at blame at circumstances, at the serpent, at the wife, or at God, but neither one of the parties involved, and certainly the devil did not, accepted any responsibility on their own right, on their own behalf at all. So the first account of a man hiding from God because of a guilt complex is clear back in the Garden of Eden. Look at Exodus 20 and verse 18. In the giving of the law at Mount Sinai, you find the same example, except this is en masse in a very nation that God is choosing for his own. In Exodus, the 20th chapter, beginning in verse 18, they had come to the mountain. God had proved to them by great miracles, by a smoke that went up over the mountain all day long, and great fiery flames at night, by great miracles at the Red Sea, before they left Egypt, the waters of Meribah, feeding them with water and with quail and with various rainings of manna for all of this time. And, of course, you would think by now they would have gratitude. They would understand they were safely in the hands of the eternal God. But no, that isn't the way they looked at it. Here the Ten Commandments are given, and after the mountain quakes so very greatly and so on, and they are told not to get near to the mountain, God gives the commandments, culminating in verse 17, beginning in verse 18. All the people saw the thunderings and the lightnings and the noise of the trumpet and the mountain smoking. It wasn't God who did the hiding in the days of the children of Israel. It was man who said, we don't want God around. We don't want to listen to him. We don't want to see the miracles. We don't want to see the smoke. We don't listen to the thunder or the trumpet anymore. You talk to us, Moses. We'd rather hear you stutter than to listen to that great powerful sound from God. Now, there are people today who would love to go off into charismatic type things, who would love to hear some minister speak in a babble of unintelligible tongues. Who would like to see a minister walk off the platform and be suspended in air. Who want to see people leaping out of wheelchairs, eyes suddenly opening of those who are blind, the deaf hearing, people being resurrected, and great and wonderful, hair-raising miracles because they want to be in a miraculous environment because they want to know that there is power there.
This topic will be continued on the next edition in series of The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong. You're invited to learn more about these important issues through the pages of Good News magazine. In addition to his many speaking engagements, Garner Ted Armstrong also serves as editor of Good News magazine. This full-color monthly publication underscores the importance of biblical understanding in modern 20th century living. The Good News magazine. Your subscription is free of charge. There is no cost or obligation. The Good News. You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your requests along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Or you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444.